As a nation, we no longer hold our laws up with respect, right? You know, since the nation was founded, there have always been those who've broken laws, right? But it's a different concept that I'm talking about, right? I'm not talking about, you know, necessarily the breaking of laws, but it's what the nation, you know, what is the United States that we think about our laws. And when you look at it, you know, a large percentage of the nation, not really whether they're conservative or liberal, Republican or Democrats, you know, a large portion of the nation is willing to just ignore laws that they don't believe in, right? That they don't like, that they don't think should be laws. Right, rather than going through the process that we have to repeal or to change a law, they'll just ignore it, right? Just not enforce it, not do anything about it, right? And part of the problem is just the volume of laws that we have, right? You know, I'm sure we've all heard about, you know, the stacks of paper of regulations that we have and how many words it is compared to the Bible. Right, and so definitely part of the problem is this volume of laws that we have and the regulations that come out and how frequently they change. But that's only part of the problem, right? Even big laws that we have, they're just in many cases not enforced, right? And they're not even enforced by those who are responsible for enforcing them, right? And not to be political or anything like that. This is just an observation, right? You know, you could say fact. You know, examples of almost all the modern presidents where they've just ignored laws, right? You know, as some of the more recent examples, our former president, Mr. Obama, he was, you know, head of the executive branch, and the responsibility of that executive branch is to enforce laws, right? And so that was his job, is to lead this branch of government to enforce laws. And in several high-profile cases, he actually, you know, commanded or told those who were underneath him to not enforce the laws that were on the books, right? To just ignore them, to not enforce them. And actually, they would have gotten in trouble if they would have enforced them, right? We have states that just ignore federal laws, right, that they don't like. And there's no, you know, nothing that's done to them because they just ignore the laws, right? And we don't even actually have to look very far about those who flaunt breaking the laws, because, you know, a very common one that I'm sure a majority in this room probably broke today were speed limits, right? Just as a good example of speed limits, you know, and I'm right there too. But, you know, we know that the police don't enforce them as they're written, right? You know, you, as long as you stay, you know, 5-10 miles over the speed limit, you're pretty good, unless maybe a policeman is having a bad day or they have a quota to fill. But, you know, in general, it's just a law that we see and we said, yeah, you know, we'll go plus or minus 10% on it and we'll be good, right? And, you know, we see these, and you could make a lot of excuses for why we do them, right? You know, we say the laws aren't good, or they're, you know, speed limits are too slow, or, you know, whatever the rationale we make. And these are just examples, right? And there's many more that we could give. But, you know, there's just an observation that there's this general lack of respect for the laws that we have in our nation. Right, but we know, right, we have another law that we are held responsible for keeping, and that is the law of God, right? The law that comes from this word that he has given to us. And we know that this law is very important, right? It's not something that we should take lightly. It's not something that we should just decide, you know, plus or minus 10%, we're fine, right? God gives, you know, in this case, very few laws, just very few principles that we are supposed to follow, and we're supposed to follow them very closely, right? And that there's a high penalty for breaking these laws. And so today, what I want to do is I want to review what we believe about the law. We want to review about what we believe about sin and God's law. What does the Bible say, and what do we believe? And so this is going to be part one of three about fundamental belief number five, sin and God's law. And like I said, this is an important one, because in many ways, as a culture, you know, we've just basically decided that laws, while You know, they're there. We don't have to follow them. And it can be something that we, as God's people, you know, can get into this mindset that, you know, we're trying to be good, or, you know, whatever our excuse may be. But God's word is very clear about how he upholds his law and how what he thinks about his law. So let's dive right in, because there's a lot to look at around this subject. So the first statement of the fundamental belief, it says, we believe that sin is the transgression of the law. Right, and this comes very clearly from a well-known verse in the King James Version. This is 1 John 3:4, and as I said, this is the King James Version. It says, whoever committeth sin transgresseth also the law, for sin is the transgression of the law. And this phrase, the transgression of the law, is interesting. It's actually just one Greek word. So it's G458, and it's a noma. And that's what it means, is it means the condition of without a law, because you either ignore it or because you're violating it, right? And then another is contempt and violation of the law, iniquity, wickedness, right? And so it gives kind of a very broad definition, right? And when you look at this in the King James Version, this word anomia is typically translated just as iniquity. Right, and so 12 out of the 14 instances where this word is used, it's just translated as iniquity. And in fact, this 1 John 3:4 is the only place where it's translated as this phrase, the transgression of the law. Right, and if we read it in the New King James, it reads a little bit differently. This is New King James, this is 1 John 3:4. It says, whoever commits sin also commits lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness. Right, and so here that phrase, the transgression of the law, is simply translated as lawlessness. Right, and Jesus uses the same Greek word multiple times in his teaching. I'll just give a couple of examples. This is in one example is in Matthew 7:23. It's Matthew 7:23. It says, and then I declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. And then later in Matthew, in the book of Matthew, Matthew 23:28, that's Matthew 23:28, it says, even so you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Right, and when you look at the times where it's typically used, and these are a couple of the examples, as I said, the context is not just a one-time sin. You know, I think we can also often think about transgression of the law as, you know, I just had one sin, I broke the law, and, you know, that's the transgression of sin. But when you look at it in these additional contexts, and I think even how the New King James translates it, the full meaning is more than just a one-time breaking of God's law, right? It's a lifestyle. It's a way of life, a habit. And that's what the Apostle John was talking about, right? Is that sin is the transgression of the law. Yes, it's the being opposed to God's law, not just a one-time thing, but in our very nature, right? It's being opposed to God's law, to his will, not just breaking just one aspect of the law or breaking it just one time. And that's what John is talking about. He's talking about a way of life. The habit, the bad habit of sinning. That is what, you know, sin is. And so when we look at it, you know, as I said, it's just not this one time mere, you could say, transgression of the law once, but it's something bigger. You know, it's this lifestyle of sin, a lifestyle of lawlessness that people have. It's going against God's law, going against, as I said, God's will. And for us, you know, in this physical life, for as long as we are alive, we'll always be sinning. We'll always be prone to sinning, I should say. And as, you know, as we can look in various places, there's kind of three broad ways that we sin, right? The first one is, of course, we just overtly break God's commandments, right? And we see that as sin. An example is, or a verse that would state that is 1 John 5:17. It says, all unrighteousness is sin, and there is sin not leading to death. Right, but that's only one of the ways. Of course, the other way that we know about, which might be even harder to keep, right, is omitting doing what we know we should do is sin. Right, this is James 4:17. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. Right? That's a very high bar, right? I mean, that's, you know we should do something, and if we know it, we have to go do it, or it's sin to us. It's transgressing God's law. Because when you look at it, that's what God does, right? God sees that something should be done, and he always goes and does it perfectly. And so as we are trying to become like God, that is important, that it's not just, you know, not breaking God's law as it's written. It's also doing good when we see that there's that opportunity. And then another example, or you could say maybe the third broad way that we sin is we violate our conscience, right? Which is, again, a pretty high bar, right? It's not even that you necessarily overtly break God's law. It's just that you think you're breaking God's law, and then you continue doing it, that's sin, right? That's Romans 14:23. Romans 14:23, it says, "But he who doubts is condemned if he eats, because he does not eat from faith. For whatever is not from faith is sin," right? So if we don't have faith in God, if we don't believe that we're doing the right thing, that's accounted sin to us, right? And of course, that example was someone who was eating meat given to idols. You know, Paul said that that wasn't sin, but for that person who that it's, you know, hit their conscience, then it would be counted as sin because they were, you know, you could say skirting God's law. That might be the speed limit form of breaking God's law, where you, yeah, you're not quite sure if it is or not, but you go ahead and do it anyway. God says, no, my, you know, his standard is much higher. If you think it might be breaking God's law, if you're not confident that it's fully compliant with God's law, then it's breaking God's law, right? He doesn't want us to get into this habit of thinking that his law is just something that we can, you know, work around the edges, that we can, you know, make, you know, kind of get as close to that line as possible, but not break it. Right? And so we know that, you know, to keep these three areas fully, you know, like the Father does, like the Son does, to keep them in that manner, right, is something that's impossible for us in this life without the Holy Spirit working in us. Right? And this point that John was making is essentially the same point that Paul makes in Romans. And we'll turn over there because we'll be there for a little bit. But in Romans 7:7, let's read what Paul says. He says, "What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law. For I would not have known covetousness unless the law had said, 'You shall not covet.'" Right? And this Paul is making clear that this is the only way that we know what sin is, right? It's by knowing the law of God. And Paul makes clear that the law he is talking about, right? It's not some new law that's being brought. It's not something that, you know, we just have to trust in Jesus, or we just have to be good or kind or nice, or whatever churches today teach, right? No, this is, you know, something that is very clear. He's pointing us back, or referencing us back directly to the Old Testament law, right? And he uses one of the Ten Commandments to do it, right? And he's making it clear that it's, you know, there is no justification for not following God's law, right? Not knowing God's law, right? And while this is, you know, as I said, he's pointing back to the last of the Ten Commandments, he's really pointing back to the full Mosaic law, you know, as it's called, right? He uses this just as an example that he does in other places where they just pick one example, but you refer back to something bigger. And that's what he's saying. It's saying is that by knowing the law that was given to Moses, that's how we know what sin is, right? And as we know, the law given to Moses was very broad, right? We have the Ten Commandments. We'll look at other places, but it's not just some, you know, small, very very kind of, you look at the words and there's nothing more. No, there's principles behind it that we have to understand, that we have to learn, that we have to be able to apply. And so Paul goes on to explain in Romans 7:8, it says, "But sin, taking opportunity by the commandment, produced in me all manner of evil desire. For apart from the law, sin was dead. I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died." Right? So again, Paul is emphasizing that the only way that we know what sin is by knowing the law of God, right? Knowing God's law, and that is what defines sin. And then going on in verse 10, it says, "And the commandment, which was to bring life, I found to bring death. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it killed me." Right, and then this leads, as we continue on in Romans, leads to the second point of the fundamental belief. So the first one is that, you know, sin is the transgression of the law, and you can't have one without the other. You have to know one to understand what the other one is. But then point two of the fundamental belief, the law is spiritual, perfect, holy, just, and good. Right, and as we continue on here in Romans 7 verse 12, it states this exact thing. It says, "Therefore the law is holy, and the commandment holy and just and good. And he then, or has then, what is good become death to me? Certainly not. But sin, that it might appear sin, was producing death in me, though what is good, so that sin through the commandment might become exceedingly sinful. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin." Right, and so Paul is here explaining, right, this relationship between the law and sin. Right, he's explaining that, you know, it's not that the law is bad because it brings death. No, it's sin that has brought death, right? And we only know what is sin by knowing what is the law, right? And we see here very plainly that the law, you know, because it comes from God, it's holy, right? And because it comes from God, it's spiritual. Because it comes from God, it's just and good, right? And so this law, this thing that then he's talking about, you know, is contrasted from the evilness that is sin, right? It's sin that brought death. It's not the law that brought death, right? And then he goes on, and we'll read Romans 7, 15 through 25. It says, "For what I am doing, I do not understand. For what I will to do, that I do not practice. But what I hate, that I do." Right? And so Paul here is talking about kind of the very practical interaction that we have with law and sin, right? We as Christians, we know what is sin. We know what we are not to do. But here, you know, he's stating that he, you know, continues to struggle after all this time, all the walk that he had in the faith, right? He continues to struggle with this fact. And as I, you know, mentioned before, you know, the law is of this very high bar, right? I mean, it's not just breaking the law. You have to do what is good. You have to, you know, not kind of come close to that line. You have to be very clear about what God is telling us to do and make sure that we follow it 100%. Right? And Paul is saying that, you know, he knows that he's not doing it up to that level, up to that bar that God holds for us all. And then in verse 16 it says, "If then I do what I will not to do, I agree with the law that it is good. But now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, nothing good dwells. For to will is present with me, but how to perform what is good I do not find. For the good that I will to do, I do not do." Right? Again, you know, kind of referencing back to the fact that it's not just breaking God's law, it's actually that we have to do good. Right? And he's saying, "For the good that I will to do." You know, he sees something that he should be doing and then he doesn't do it. "But the evil I will not to do, that I practice." You could say that's the breaking of God's law overtly. And then in verse 20 it says, "Now if I do what I will not to do, it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. I find then a law that evil is present in, or I find then a law that evil is present with me, the one who wills to do good. For I delight in the law of God according to the inward man. But I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members. O wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then, with the mind, I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin." Right, and this is such a beautiful set of scriptures, I think, at least for me it is, because it gives me such hope, right? You know, here it's Paul, and we think about Paul's life, right? You think about, you know, in some ways, it, you know, much like David, he was a man, you know, who sinned greatly, right? Especially early in his life. So he sinned, you know, greatly, persecuting the faith, you know, having people killed, having people stoned, right? But then he becomes such a dedicated follower of Christ, an apostle even, right? And here he is, he turned from, you know, this persecutor with such zeal that he persecuted Christ and or those who were Christians, but he used that zeal and he became, you know, such a zealous follower of Christ, right? And it was through this miraculous conversion. And so you would think that, you know, this great apostle, right, after all these years would have tamed all of this inward or this fleshly desires that he had. But he's saying, you know, even after all these years, he hadn't been able to fully overcome sin in the physical flesh. In his mind he had, but not in his flesh, right? And so this should give us great hope, right, that when we continue to sin, when we continue to have these struggles, when we continue to have these battles in ourselves, right, that even the greatest of the men in the Bible battled the same battle to the very end, right? And we're in the same place that each and every one of us were, right? And so when we look at this, you know, this the in John and then here in Romans, these are essentially the same sentiment, right? That the Apostle John was saying when he said sin is lawlessness, right? It's a lifestyle. It's not just a one-time thing, right? He's saying, you know, essentially, I sin, so I transgress the law. But it's more than just that. It's this whole lifestyle. It's something that you battle to the very end, right? And we read why later down in Romans, Paul says, you know, it's because the carnal mind that each of us have, that each of us is trying to come out of, right, is enmity against God. For it is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. Right? It's something that we're going to battle for a lifetime. But it also shows how evil sin really is, right? And how much it's consumed mankind, right? And how it's taken something that was perfect and good and holy and righteous and that came from God and was supposed to be something that would be good for us, right? It takes the law and it makes us, you know, potentially being, if we were apart from God, potentially fearful of it because it condemns us to death. Right, but we know that Christ is there to make sure that we don't have to be fearful of the law, but that it's there for us to understand what is sin and how not to sin. Right, and so you have this holy and perfect just law that is used, right, by the corrupting nature of sin to cast a death penalty on us all. Right, and it's not sin. It's not that sin corrupts the law, but it uses the law and our inability to follow the law in the flesh to corrupt you and I, right? It corrupts us all. And it just did the same for the Apostle Paul. It did the same for the Apostle John, as we just read, right? And so with this context, right, of how sin and the law are related, right, how it's not just a one-time transgression that we talk about, but it's this lifestyle of sin that we have and that we're going to battle to the very end, right? Let's move on to the third statement of our fundamental belief, right? So we see, you know, that sin is this transgression of the law, but the law is this perfect and holy and just thing, right? And so what is the law? You know, how is it defined? And that's our third statement. It says the law defines God's love, right? And that puts it in a very clear context, right? Because we know that God is love, right? And so how do we break that down? You know, you could say that's a very high level statement. You know, it's something that if we didn't understand the details, you could take many different ways. But that's what the law is there for us to understand, right? The law is there to help each and every one of us to understand what God's love really is. You know, if God is love, what is it that we are to become if we're to become like him? And that's what the law gives us. So let's, you know, be clear that there is this connection from the law and God's love before we move on, though. And so Christ, you know, on that last Passover, as he's teaching, you know, his apostles for the last time, makes this connection between the law and God's love very clear. In John 14:21, it says, "He who has my commandments and keeps them, it is he who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest myself to him." And then in dropping down to John 15:10, it says, "If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love." Right, and sometimes these statements are taken out of context, saying that Christ was bringing a new law, a new commandment, right? But his apostles, being Jews, would have had no trouble understanding what commandments he's talking about, right? These weren't something new that Christ was bringing. Yes, he came to expand them. He came to make sure that they were fulfilled, right? But it was not some new commandment that he was bringing. He's referring back to the commandments that the law of God, you know, was given to Moses. He was referring back to the Ten Commandments, to the full set of laws that God gave to Moses and the children of Israel. And so that's what he's talking about, right? So Christ clearly states that to understand God's love, we must keep his commandments. And even more, we can't just, you know, keep, or more than just knowing them, right? We have to actually keep them to fully understand what God's love is, right? We can read them academically. We can, try to dissect them in any many different ways. But really, to understand God's love, we must keep them, right? We must take these laws that we read about, and we must apply them to our own lives. And so that's the level of understanding that we must have, much like what Dr. Merritt, you know, mentioned. You see it, you do it, you teach it, right? And this is what God is telling us, is if we want to understand his love, if we want to understand what his whole being is about, we have to not just read these laws, we have to learn them, we have to be able to apply them to ourselves, and then ultimately, yes, he's going to be expecting each of and every one of us to be able to teach him, to be able to teach him to the rest of mankind, right? And so that's the level of understanding that is being talked about here, right? It's not just some academic reading of the law. It's not looking at the words and being able to know what the words mean. No, it's being able to apply them to our lives, to be able to make them, you know, part of us each and every day, how we act, how we think, how we respond to different situations, right? And to ensure, you know, there's no doubt, Paul also, in both Romans and Galatians, emphasizes this point about the connection between the law and love. And the first one is in Romans 13:10. It says, "Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law." Right? And so we see here, what is, you know, the law? Or what is love? It's the fulfillment of the law, right? They go together. There's a connection between them. And then in Galatians 5:14, it says, "For all the law is fulfilled in one word," right? And what is this one word? "Even in this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself," right? Again, law and love, they go together. They're not separate things. They're not, you know, things that are meant to be apart, right? And so in both of these cases, it's kind of written in reverse of what the fundamental belief is, or our fundamental belief is, but it leaves no doubt, right, that the law and love are complementary, right? They are not at odds. To have one, you must keep the other. To fulfill one, you must do the other, right? And to define one, you must read and understand the other, right? They go together. You can't understand them. You can't do either one apart from the other. Right, and so how do we fulfill the law? You know, what does fulfilling the law actually mean? And we'll go into much more detail in the, probably the next one in this series. But this leads us to essentially the fourth statement, our fundamental belief, right? Which is the law is based upon two great principles of love towards God and love towards the neighbor, or towards our neighbor, right? And it's interesting that, you know, as we'll read in Matthew, Christ makes clear that the whole law hangs on love, right? Love for two different people, or two different sets, but still it hangs on love, right? And so we can turn over to Matthew 22:34, where it says, "But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. Then one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him." Right? And so again, you know, they were always testing Christ, trying to see, you know, if they could break him, if they could make him, you know, say a mistake, have him go against the word of God. But we know what he responds. It says, "And saying," and then in verse 36 it says, "Teacher, what is the great commandment in the law?" Right? And you know, when I read this, I wonder what he thought Christ was going to say, right? Was he going to say, "Oh, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy," or, you know, "You shall not murder"? Was he going to, you know, pick one of the Ten Commandments, and then they might have thought they had him, right? But he, you know, he doesn't do that, right? He goes right to the heart of the matter, you could say. In this, in verse 37, it says, "Jesus said to him, 'You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment.'" And it's interesting because he could have just stopped there, right? I mean, that's what the teacher or the lawyer asked them, right? He said, "Just which is the greatest commandment?" And he makes very clear, you know, what is the greatest commandment, right? That you shall love the Lord your God. But he doesn't stop there because of the importance of the second one. And then verse 39, Matthew 22:39, Christ goes on and says, "And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." Right? And so, as I said, you know, I think it's interesting that he didn't just stop with one, because that's what the lawyer asked him, was what is the greatest? And Christ was clear that there is one first and great commandment, right? And that's our relationship with God. But there's a second one that's so intertwined with the first one, is you can't really have the first without the second. And so that's why there are these two great principles, right? And John makes clear, right? Makes this clear, you know, if Christ wasn't clear enough, that you can't obey one of these without obeying the other, right? We can look in 1 John 4:20. It says, "If someone says, 'I love God,' and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? And this commandment we have from him, that he who loves God must love his brother also." Right? So you kind of, you know, again, I kind of wonder as I read this, you know, why would he have written it? Because like I said, you know, I think Christ and how he responded was pretty clear that it wasn't, you know, one, and then you could kind of decide if you obeyed the second one or not. You know, by going beyond what the lawyer had asked him and given both of these at the same time, he makes very clear in my mind that they go together, that you can't do one without the other. But you know, you could imagine potentially those at the time of John, right, that thought they were clever by, you know, saying that they followed this great commandment, that they loved God. And so they didn't, you know, worry so much about this second one, this one that's, you know, maybe not important, right? And, you know, of course, that's how we would justify, right, it to ourselves, right? We would justify to ourselves if, you know, we didn't, you know, like somebody, or if we didn't want to do good for somebody, that, oh, you know, we love God, right? And this was, you know, essentially what the Pharisees were saying in a lot of the ways that they did, right? They you know, when they talked about, you know, they didn't do good for their parents because they were going to donate money to the temple, right? And this is what God is saying here, and what John is emphasizing, is that you can't love God without loving your neighbor. So it's really these two principles together, right? And John, you know, in some ways makes it clear that, you know, that they go hand in hand, right? And that it's essentially impossible, right? If you can't even love the person who's standing in front of you, the person that you see, the person that you're with right now, there's no way that you can love God. I mean, yes, you can say it, you can pray to God, you can, you know, say all the right things, you might even be able to, you know, very strictly keep the law of God, but both Christ and John here are saying that you have to actually love the person that's in front of you, right? And it's much harder, I would say, in a lot of ways to love the person that's right in front of you because, you know, they do things that you don't like. They do things that get you upset. They do things that, you know, can frustrate you. But if we can't even treat that person with love, if we can't even love them to the same depth that we're supposed to, you know, how are we really going to love God who we've never seen, right? And it's, you know, in many ways, this is likely in response to just our own justification of why we treat people poorly, right? Well, we love God, so this is not as important. But John is making clear that you can't love God, you know, not truly love him how Christ and the Father love each other without loving our fellow man, right? And so, as Christ said, you know, though these commandments, though, didn't just originate with him, right? This wasn't something that he made up on the spot, right? This is something that goes all the way back, at least to the law that God gave to Moses. And I think when you think about it, it actually goes all the way back, you know, at least to the story of Cain and Abel, right? Because if you think about Cain and Abel, or particularly Cain, what were the two sins that Cain had, right, in that story? First, he didn't love God enough to give him the type of offering that God deserved, that he should have given God, right? And that was the first, right? He didn't love God with all his heart and with all his soul and all his strength. And then the second one is he didn't love his brother, right? So if you look at these two great commandments, they basically weave all the way back to the very beginning of the story of mankind. Like I said, with Cain breaking these two great commandments. But they're very clearly written down, of course, in the law that was given to Moses by God. And so let's read them in that context, because it, you know, I think it makes clear, more clear, that this wasn't something that should have been enlightening to the Pharisees, right? This is as keepers, as knowledgeable as they were about the law, they should have been able to pick up on these and know that these were, you know, the two greatest commandments that were given, right? Even though they weren't necessarily given in that order as clearly as maybe how we would have written them down, right? Because, you know, in our day and age, we would have said, okay, here's the two great commandments, and then here's the Ten Commandments, and here's this law and that law. But it's not, you know, how the Bible is written in many cases. We have to go explore, we have to go and understand, and we have to look at the principles that God is giving us. Right, and so if we turn to the first one, Deuteronomy 6, verse 1, and we kind of look at the context, this first great commandment is given as Moses was reviewing the Ten Commandments with the children of Israel. And just, you know, to kind of set the stage a little bit, if we look back in Deuteronomy, this is, you know, essentially the retelling of the law to the generation of Israelites that are going into the promised land, right? So this is basically at the very end of Moses' life, not long after this. It's not told exactly, but if you read it, it seems to indicate this is pretty much right as he is going to be leaving the children of Israel, right? He's about to hand over the command, or the responsibility, you might say, of the children of Israel to Joshua. And so he's has one last, you could say, message that he's trying to give to the children of Israel. And he starts off, you know, kind of one of the first things is a review of the Ten Commandments, which shows the importance that they do have. But in this message in Deuteronomy 6 verse 1, right after he retells the Ten Commandments, he goes on and he talks about this. So we'll read here in Deuteronomy 6 verse 1. Now this is the commandment, and these are the statutes and judgments which the Lord your God has commanded to teach you, that you may observe them in the land which you are crossing over to possess. Right, and so as I said, this is given not to that first generation of Israelites that came out of the land of Egypt, but it's given to the second generation of Israelites who are about to go take possession of the promised land, right? And that's who he's teaching this to. And you know, as we read on, you could say that this is why he puts so much emphasis on this great commandment, right? That they understand not just the physical aspects, not just the, you know, words or the laws as they're written, while that's very important, but that they are to understand that there's principles that underlie all these laws, and it's these principles that we have to learn, that we have to go and explore and dig into to be able to fully keep the law of God. And then, so moving on in Deuteronomy 6 verse 2, it says that you may fear the Lord your God to keep his statutes, his commandments, which I command you, you and your son and your grandson, all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. Right, and so again, if you think about this context, this is why we can be so clear and so confident that what Christ was talking about was not some new set of commandments, was not some new law that he'd come to introduce. He's referring back to this section of scriptures in the greatest commandment, right? And here, you know, Moses is clear what law he's talking about, right? All his statutes and his commandments, right? Which I commanded you, which, you know, being Moses, right? And so that's why we can be so confident, so clear, that what Jesus was talking about was this commandment that God had given Moses, you know, hundreds of years or thousands of years before, right? And so then in verse Deuteronomy 6 verse 3, it says, therefore hear, O Israel, and be careful to observe it, that it may be well with you, and that you may multiply greatly as the Lord God of your fathers has promised you, a land flowing with milk and honey. And then in verse 4, it says, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. Right? And so as I said, it's, you know, this is the set of scriptures that Christ is referring to. And, you know, he could have easily, you know, quoted this whole section of scriptures. But just, you know, in that day and age, how the Jews did it is they would just give maybe one verse, or, you know, they didn't have verses at that time, but one thought. Not that that thought was the only thing that was important, but that it would then refer you back to that entire set of scriptures. So, you know, essentially you would then go back and study that full set of scriptures to understand what was really being meant. And so here we see, you know, what Christ was referring back to, right? Was this whole law, right? And that the important part was that you do it because you love God, that you follow this one great commandment, and that these words, right, are not just stored in your brain, are not just written on some piece of paper, but that they actually will be in their heart, right? That it will actually change how they act, how they respond, how they think, how they feel. Right, and then the second commandment, it's in Leviticus 19, and I'll read 17 and 18 just to set some context. It says in Leviticus 19, 17, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him. So it's saying, right, it's saying you shall not hate your brother. But then it goes on and it, you know, as it says, rebuke your neighbor. I mean, basically what it's saying is, you know, don't hold a grudge. Don't be silent if something is bothering you. Go talk to them. Go make sure that they understand, but don't bear sin because of them, right? Don't hold this grudge because of them. And then in verse 18, it goes on, you shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Right? And so he makes clear that this commandment, you know, is because he's the Lord, right? This is what he expects you to do, right? And so it talks, you know, and if you read further in Leviticus 19 and the verses that precede it, it talks about this relationship that you're supposed to have with your brother, how you're supposed to interact with him. And here, as I said, you know, it gives you this warning that you don't hold a grudge, you don't hold it in, that you go and talk to your brother, and that this is, you know, one of the ways that you love your neighbor as yourself, right? And that you do it because the Lord is the Lord, right? You do it because that's what he commands. And then we'll look at just one more place where Moses repeats actually the first of the great commandments. This is in Deuteronomy 11 verse 1. It says, Therefore, you shall love the Lord your God and keep his charge, his statutes, his judgments, and his commandments always. So again, you know, emphasizing the fact that you follow this great commandment, this loving God, by following all God's other commandments that he had given the children of Israel, right? It's not, you know, something new. As I said, yes, Christ came to fulfill the law, to make it more clear, to actually expand it and make it, you know, more like he and how he and the Father keep it. But it's these laws that he's pointing back to, right? And so it's not just some simple, you know, follow the words as they are in the book, you know, say in Leviticus or Numbers or Deuteronomy, right? Even though we must do that. But as Christ said, even the Pharisees did that, right? Christ, though, makes it clear that, you know, and as we've looked at some of the verses, that there's deeper principles behind all these laws that we must pull out from the books of the law, right? That we must be able to understand and apply in any situation, you know, even where that law might look like it doesn't apply today, in many times or many cases, and we'll look at this in more depth in a future sermon, you can take those principles, even from laws that don't apply, you know, because of how they're you know, they're written for a lifestyle that's different than ours. But you can take the principles that underlie them and they apply today, right? And that's what this is referring us back to, that we have to be able to look at and understand and kind of understand to be able to apply for ourselves, to be able to understand how deep and broad God's law is and how that it is based off these principles of loving God and loving your neighbor, right? And that they all hang off of those two great principles. So we've been, you know, talking about these laws and these great principles, you know, but as I, you know, moving into the fourth point, kind of the last one that we'll cover today, you know, is it like the laws of man? You know, I talked about, you know, today if we don't like a law, you know, there's a way that we can go and repeal it or change it or do away with it. But God's laws, you know, not like the laws of man. It's not something that can change over time. It's not something that, you know, if we depend on it today, it changes to something else, right? And that's the fourth section of a fundamental belief. It says, it being the law is immutable and binding. All right, and we can look at many different places to read how God's law is immutable and binding. We read some of them just before. You know, and kind of in simple terms, you can say immutable and binding just means that it doesn't change and that it can't be broken, right? God's not going to change the law at any time. It's not going to be broken because somebody doesn't want to enforce it. No, God's being clear that he's going to, you know, keep the law as it is forever and that he's going to enforce it at all times, right? But I think some of the clearest are from the Psalms, right, where King David writes about it. And we know that David was a lover of the law, right? Even though there were many times where he broke the law of God very deeply, right? Just like we read about Paul and John, that, you know, he broke God's law, but it never stopped him from being a lover of God's law, right? He had it such a deep part of him, just like Paul and John did. And he loved it because it showed him clearly what his sins were. It showed him clearly what was separating him from God, right? And that once he knew him, once he knew that he had sinned, right, he could then take them to God and repent deeply of them. So let's look at just, and I'll just read them. You can copy down the verses and I'll just read them quickly. But the first one is in Psalms 111, verse 7. It says, the works of his hands are verity and justice. All his precepts are sure. They stand fast forever and ever and are done in truth and uprightness. And then in Psalms 119, 142, that's Psalms 119, 142, it says, your righteousness is an everlasting righteousness, and your law is truth. And then dropping down a couple of verses to 144, it says, the righteousness of your testimonies is everlasting. Give me understanding, and I shall live. And then dropping down some more in verse 160, it says, the entirety of your word is truth, and every one of your righteous judgments endures forever. Right? And so David is telling us that these laws that God has given us are not like the laws of our nation, right? They can change from election to election. These are not, you know, laws of mankind. No, these are laws like the physical laws, right? They're unchanging. There's something that we can count on, right? Just like we can count on gravity or friction or any of the other natural law that God has given us, right? And when you look at them, I wonder if God gave these physical laws that are, you know, unchanging, that we can count on, that we can build, you know, systems off of. We can build cars, and we can build houses because of them. If he gave them as an example of how unchangeable his spiritual laws are, right? That they're binding, that there's nothing that we can do to break them, right? You know, no one would even believe that we can break, the law of gravity or the law of friction. And at least when I look at him, there's one of the things that I think about with those physical laws is he gave them to us as that example, right? That just like these physical laws cannot be broken, we can't break, or he can't break his spiritual law, right? They're just unchanging, unbroken, right? And so, you know, just as we'd looked at the beginning, you know, this law and sin are tied very closely together. And what we've looked at is really just scratching the surface of what we could have, even in this section of the fundamental belief of how important God's law is and how it's tied to sin, right? There's much more that we could study. But one of the things, you know, as I was studying this that struck me is how practical this fundamental belief is. You know, we've gone through the first few, you know, about Satan, about the Godhead, about other things, and they're very important. You know, don't get me wrong. They're you know, how we understand the context of this. But this one to me feels like one of the most practical ones, right? Because it's the basis for how we deepen our relationship with the Father in Christ. It's how we deepen our relationship with each and every one of us in this room, right? How we start building our relationship with our brothers and sisters, right? You know, of course, starting with those in this room, but has to extend to all those that we come in contact with, right? Because if we want to have a deep relationship with God and Christ, it starts with their law and with sin, right? Look at David. You think about that example of David. Why did he have such a deep relationship with God? Right? It's because he loved the law of God. Right? Oh, how I love the love your law. It is my meditation all the day. Right? He spent time with it. He understood it. I mean, yes, right? He broke it, as we know each and every one of us do. But he loved that law so much, right? These are the words, you know, of someone that knew God's law, right? And because he knew God's law, he knew God, right? Yes, he sinned, right? He came, but, you know, every time he sinned, he came back to God, right? And what did God do, right? And God, in all of his tender mercies, he embraced David. He embraced David every time David came back. And David loved God all the more for it, right? And as we read with Paul, it's the same with Paul, right? Paul knew that he was breaking God's law day in and day out. But he knew because that he was breaking God's law, he knew what to change. He knew how to go to God and ask for repentance. He knew what, you know, needed to change. And he knew that deep down, right, in his heart, that he didn't want to sin. He knew that he had the weakness of the flesh that caused him to sin, but he knew deep down that he didn't want to sin. And I would, you know, venture to say that David was the exact same, right? That David, while he had the weakness in the flesh of sinning, deep down he didn't want to sin, right? Even when he did it, he knew it was the wrong thing and that he would go back to God, right? So when we look at, you know, these three examples, Paul and John, as we read at the very beginning, and David, right? All three of these men knew God's law very deeply. They all sinned, but they knew what sin did to them, right? They knew that it separated them from God, and that if they wanted to have this deep relationship with God, they had to know what their sins were. They had to know what to repent of, but they also knew, right, what Christ had done for them. They knew that they could go back to God and repent every single time, right? And they love the law of God because of this. And they love God all the more because it because of how he brought them back every time, how he embraced them no matter how much they sinned or what they sinned about, right? And it's all kind of hanging on this understanding that the law of God convicted them of their sins, and so they knew how to get back into a relationship with God and Christ. And so we'll explore that kind of much more deeply in the future messages in this series. But to close, what I want to do is I want to read the full set of the fundamental belief number 5, which is sin and God's law. It says, "We believe that sin is the transgression of the law. The law is spiritual, perfect, holy, just, and good. The law defines God's love and is based upon the two great principles of love towards God and love towards neighbor. It is immutable and binding. The Ten Commandments are the 10 points of God's law of love. We believe that breaking any one point of the law brings upon a person the penalty of sin. We believe that this fundamental spiritual law reveals the only way to true life and the only possible way of happiness, peace, and joy. All unhappiness, misery, anguish, and woe have come from the transgression of God's law."